thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's January 2021, and you're listening to episode 218, which is a discussion about the DC superhero Wonder Woman, as well as a discussion of the recent film Wonder Woman 1984. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who is a recent seminary graduate and an author for the website Christ in Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal, and his review is called Wonder Woman 1984, The Truth is Enough. You can read his review for free online at our website, equip.org. Cole, it's good to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Well, as I mentioned, we are going to be talking about the film Wonder Woman 1984. But before we do that, I just want to ask Cole a little bit more about the DC character itself, because I think a lot of times some of the people seeing these new films are not, you know, familiar with the comic books and some of the history of certain characters. And I also want to warn our listeners that this is going to be, as most of our film reviews are, spoiler filled. So if you plan to see Wonder Woman 1984 and you don't mind spoilers before, you're like one of those kinds of people who wants to know, you know, how movie ends type of thing, you can listen on or come back to this later after you've seen the film. But we hope this will be a really interesting discussion, because I don't always talk about kind of the backstory and some of the background, because not all of our reviewers for superhero material actually have read the comics. So tell us a little bit more about Wonder Woman personally for you as a character. What was your first exposure to her?
So my first exposure to Wonder Woman, it was actually not the comics. In the mid to late 70s, there was a television series starring Linda Carter. Now, the 70s were like well before my time, but I have a sister who really loved the character, and somehow we ended up with these DVD box sets of the Linda Carter show. So when we were younger and we'd be in the back of the car on road trips or something like that, I can remember watching episodes of Wonder Woman with Linda Carter, as well as the Bill Bixby Incredible Hulk series. So both of those shows, I guess, can seem a little dated and campy now, but they did have charm and some really solid moments. And I think for a lot of people for a long time, those were the definitive versions of those comic book characters. So I came to Wonder Woman by way of Linda Carter.
I think I might have seen a few of those episodes when they were actually on TV, but I'm not sure. I might have been just aware. And I say that because I wasn't allowed to watch TV. So if I did see it, it might have been stealth. So how do the film adaptations differ from particularly the comic book source material? How is the comic books about Wonder Woman different from, like, this is the second time she's had a movie focused just on her? And I just also want to tell our listeners that we did do a review of the first Wonder Woman movie, and there is a film review, so you can find that at our website, equip.org.
So I guess apart from the obvious translation from book to screen, a good way of approaching this question is to understand the character's evolution throughout history. You know, comic book characters always change with the times. It's part of their appeal. And I don't think we can really understand or even appreciate just how subtly and thoroughly these characters have integrated themselves into pop culture over the past, you know, 80 or 90 years. As far as Wonder Woman is concerned, she originally appeared in a comic book series titled All-Star Comics in October of 1941. She was the creation of a psychologist, interestingly enough, named William Moulton Marston, and a comic book artist named Harry G. Peter. Now, Marston was a pretty different sort of guy. He lived with his wife, and they had another lady with them named Mary Olive Byrne. I guess their domestic partner is the nice way of describing that complex relationship. Anyway, Marston, who had a hand in inventing the polygraph, actually, supposedly took some inspiration for the character from his wife and this woman who lived with them. And in a pretty popular piece in a 1943 issue of the American Scholar, he wrote that the goal of creating the character was to create a very beautiful and very strong woman, which wasn't really popular back in the early 40s in the comic book medium. So that's just a little background on the character. And like all those comic book characters back then, she went through the war years as an American icon. That's really, I guess, how the character started, almost as a piece of anti-Nazi propaganda. And then the character has been constantly recreated throughout the classic comic book eras, from the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, into the modern age. And different, even conflicting sometimes, origin stories emerge, basically making it a nightmare for anybody who is interested in trying to follow or maintain a kind of continuity between versions of the character. So what these film versions of the characters tend to do are take all of those different jumping on points and comic book versions of the character, and they essentially just condense them into a singular timeline that fits the movie. And then they basically pick and choose the powers that they want to give her. So, for example, apart from the lasso and the bracelets, which are there in those early stories, Wonder Woman never used, you know, a sword. Well, nowadays, her sword and shield are just as iconic as any other piece of her arsenal. So the film adaptations are basically just distilled versions of the comic books and all the history that comes with that. I hope that sort of explains the difference there.
Well, I know in popular culture, it's, you know, kind of this maybe not a competition, but, you know, it's DC versus Marvel. And Wonder Woman is part of the DC universe. And for the most part, people are saying it's not as good of a universe as the Marvel comics. So because she's part of the DC comics, how does Wonder Woman differ from, you know, the Marvel universe? Especially, I would think, you know, if we're talking about the film, how does it differ from the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Because that's, I think, where Marvel has found a renaissance of a lot of new fans, and there haven't been maybe as successful DC films.
Your popular Marvel heroes today, you know, Iron Man, Captain America, Black Widow, and I guess this is the difference between like a Wonder Woman and those characters. They're very much humans. Diana Prince, you know, just Wonder Woman's secret identity, she's not just another human. Her origin story is much more mythic. She's an Amazonian, like in the old Greek tales. In one version, she's sculpted out of clay. In another, she's this demigod child of Zeus. You'll find closer parallels to a character like Thor in Marvel, who has these sort of mythic origins. Now, that's just from a narrative standpoint. But if you want to take, a more fundamental look at the ideas that give birth to the character, Wonder Woman has a very strong sense of, I guess, what you'd call old feminism, which is almost a different brand entirely from some of the feminist ideas floating around today, where you really see the sacrifice of femininity and an overemphasis of the masculine. This is something that current film adaptations, like the 2017 film with Patty Jenkins, who directed it, does well. You see the differences on display when you hold up that film, the 2017 film, over against like the 2019 Captain Marvel film. You're not going to find Carol Danvers cooing about a baby, you know, minutes before walking into a war zone. Carol Danvers is a very masculine sort of female hero, where a lot of what you might traditionally call, you know, feminism or feminist values, these caring characteristics are downplayed. And that walks in lockstep with a lot of modern feminist ideas. With Wonder Woman, though, you have a very strong sense of femininity maintained within the character while still giving her these very pronounced masculine traits. There's a very good synergy between the two of them that I think makes for a very compelling hero figure who is really unlike a lot of other characters dominating the zeitgeist now. So that at least is, I think, some of the ways Wonder Woman differs from a lot of the popular heroes coming out of Marvel comics.
And just kind of like to push into that a little bit and think a little bit more about how they differ is, do you think there's some broader differences between the stories that DC Comics tells and the ones that are told by Marvel?
I do. So, like you said, and it's one of the elephants in the room. You kind of have to have to talk about it a little bit. But in recent years, at least in terms of the films, I guess what you'd call a rivalry between the two companies has become more pronounced, at least in what I like to call campfire conversations, those sorts of talks between people where they're basically treated like sports teams, right? When one has a successful movie, the team's fans cheer and people will say, well, Marvel is better than DC and vice versa. Look, personally, I've never found those kinds of conversations appealing because I think on a fundamental level, the companies are doing vastly different things with their characters and the stories they choose to tell. Most of Marvel's stories tend to favor things like science fiction. Their stories tend to favor humanism. Consider that most of the mainstream Marvel heroes, like Iron Man or Captain America or Spider-Man, they are essentially people, basic people, who through science and technology become heroes or at least receive their heroic abilities. DC Comics, however, with the great exception being Batman, in this case, the exception proves the rule, because Bruce Wayne's humanness is what makes him unique. These major characters like Superman or Wonder Woman are not mere humans. They are almost divine in their origin or supernatural in their origin and are much more in the vein of archetypes of classic literature. Those characters are pretty much the progenitors of the modern comic book heroes because they are almost distilled perfect modern archetypes. So yeah, I think there's a huge difference in emphasis and characterization in the stories, and trying to compare the companies into which one is better is like trying to compare apples to oranges. That's how starkly different the two companies are. DC leans much more into mythological, archetypal, even timeless tropes. Marvel takes a much more grounded, humanistic approach. And what this means then is that Marvel characters tend to emerge from and speak to the present moment. DC characters, on the other hand, emerge from archetypes and are therefore a little more timeless. There is a reason that any sort of clip art or generic image of an unlicensed superhero silhouette used in any kind of marketing looks identical to Superman, complete with a cape, than it does, say, to Captain America. There is something more primal, more fundamental in the Superman image that will outlive any other. So that's what I see, at least broadly, are the differences between the two.
And because of that, do you think that maybe modern audiences don't relate to DC as much? It seems too old-fashioned to them than the Marvel heroes?
Yes, I completely agree with you, with what you've just said. I think that's a large part of it. There is a kind of emotional dissonance that happens with DC's characters. They are a little less relatable than Marvel characters. And that's not a criticism, because I think it's by design. It's meant to be that way. And the result then is that DC's characters and the stories that they tell end up looking a lot more like morality plays. They seem a little preachier in tone than a lot of Marvel's movies. You'll hear it often said this way: well, DC's movies are much more serious. In other words, they don't know how to have fun. Well, you know, that's fair if you're going to the movie wanting quips and fun. But if you look at the stories that they're telling, well, they're not designed to lean into that aspect of the superhero genre. They're doing something different on a fundamental level and telling a very different kind of story that is much more concerned really with mythological ideas. So yeah, I think it comes across old-fashioned and sort of outdated in a lot of ways.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Cole Burgett. He has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Wonder Woman 1984, The Truth is Enough. You can read it for free online at our website, equip.org. Now, as I announced last episode, this online exclusive articles that are completely free to everyone on the internet are going to start becoming an exclusive first look benefit for our subscribers. So if you'd like to read these articles, please subscribe to our journal, and you can do that for $33.50 at our website, equip.org, and you will get a look at all of the articles on which these podcasts are based, if they are online exclusives, and also if they're in the magazine, because the magazine articles are exclusive in print, and we don't put them on our website for some time once they are in print. So you can access all that content when you subscribe to the journal. In addition, if you want to help us continue to bring you this podcast, the best way you can do that to help us grow is to really rate and review the podcast. The best way to do that is on Apple Podcasts with a starred review or written review, or just simply tell a friend about this podcast and get the word out on your social media. Share these episodes on your social media accounts. In addition, you can tip us very easily at our website, equip.org. Just go to the landing page and click magazine at Postmodern Realities Podcast. Any of the landing pages for our episodes will have a link to give us a tip. But thank you for all the ways in which you partner with us. We're very grateful. And again, please subscribe to the magazine, because that's the way you're going to be able to see all of these articles that are online exclusives that we feature on this podcast. Well, I'd like to pivot a little bit from comparing and contrasting DC and Marvel to specifically talk about this character, Wonder Woman, in these two films in the last several years, and the actress Gal Gadot, who has received fairly positive reception from, you know, film critics and fans. And so what do you think that she brings to this character that has given her that reception, where sometimes, as you know, when superheroes are cast, there could be some scorn from all the fanboys or the big major fans of particular superhero characters, but people really liked her casting. And how do you think she brings something to the character that has caused people to be very positive about it?
I think she has found a way, as I sort of mentioned earlier, to bring together masculinity and femininity in her portrayal of just a woman that is uncliched and very graceful and sincere. Wonder Woman is a kind of distilled archetype, right? She's the warrior princess like Xena, played by Lucy Lawless, for example. And it's very easy to take those types of characters and sort of overplay them. You overemphasize the masculine contours of the character at the expense of the feminine. And there's the risk on the part of the writers and the filmmakers to make her, I don't know, like sexy, but not attractive, not charming, and not intelligent. And with Gal Gadot, you don't see those kinds of negative characterizations. She is a fundamentally good person who is almost an allegorical depiction of truth. Both the 2017 film, and in a lot of ways, the one that was just released, 84, both stories are about Diana coming to learn a very important truth about humanity and depravity and loss and regret. She's always growing beyond her own naivety. And that's a very honest, very resonant way to tell these stories. And in the end, she's always the character who speaks very profound truth to the world. And because of her purity and because of her strength of character, the world like rallies behind her. So in essence, she is an embodiment of goodness. And she is goodness written well, which I know the last time we talked, we said this is something that's incredibly hard to do. But when it's done well, as I think it is, at least in the 2017 film, it captures people, maybe even in ways they don't understand. She makes goodness appealing, which is so vastly different from so much of the other mainstream shows of today, that she stands out.
So I'm thinking just like about this, you know, superhero genre that we've been talking about, and it seems popular at the box office. Well, when there were actual in-person films that we could watch, although I think this one is in a few theaters, but it's also being released right now on HBO's streaming platform, HBO Now, right, or something like that.
HBO Max, I think it's called.
HBO Max. Yes, that's how I saw it. So why do you think that this kind of genre is popular? Why do you think that it resonates with people? I think it resonates really across various different generations, from littler kids to people who, like you said, Wonder Woman first appeared quite a while ago. And, you know, it's something that people have grown up with, and even boomers are familiar with superheroes. So why do you think there's this resonance with superheroes?
Yeah, so this is a huge question, and there are things I can say that are definitive, but there's no way this question doesn't just become another like hot take, or just sort of, I guess, my opinion. So couching my answer in that, I will say that the genre, in a way, the genre has never not been popular in the sense that these films came out of nowhere. If you say the genre has never been popular and then suddenly it became popular, it's like they just materialized overnight. And that's really not what happened. No, the film genre of superheroes really kind of began in the imaginations of the creators when they were children reading these comic books or watching, as you said, these older TV shows. But the, I guess what we would call the modern superhero craze, the thing that really drives people to the theaters or to get these subscription services, really began, I think, with 2005's Batman Begins. Christopher Nolan took traditional pulpy material, you know, stuff that Tim Burton would run to, and he essentially elevated it to a level of literature on screen with the complexities of plot and character that you find in like great novels. And I think that let people know that it was okay to start taking these films seriously. It was this very grounded, very visceral approach that was mature in its storytelling. And it let people know, you know, it's okay to go watch these movies without your kids. And that was, in a sense, the growing up the genre, at least the film genre, needed to do. The lightning rod was Batman Begins, and of course Iron Man followed on its heels 3 years later. Fast forward 13 years, almost 13 years, I guess, and here we are. So that's at least the origin, I think, of the modern superhero craze. I guess the question is more about what sustains it. I tend to think that has to do with what superheroes sort of represent. They really are kind of like a modern mythology. They sort of fill the void in a lot of ways that has been left by the Westerns of the earlier years. And in that regard, the moralities are very stark between good guys, bad guys, heroes, villains, that kind of thing.
So do you think, you know, and speaking about superhero stories and why they resonate with anyone and just across, you know, men and women related to it and different ages and those kinds of things, how should Christians think about superhero stories? In other words, what is something that we should consider when Christians see these movies? Should Christians see these movies? And do they make good springboards to use for apologetic conversations with people about larger spiritual issues that we can share the gospel?
Should Christians see these movies? Yes and no. That's a bit of a cop-out, but it really is kind of how I feel. Let me answer this slightly differently. It depends. It depends on the story. I can get to Jesus from Superman pretty much all day long, and twice on Sunday. You know what I mean? I can get to Jesus from Wonder Woman just as easily, but I'm going to struggle to get to Jesus with like The Flash. I'm going to struggle a little more to get to Jesus from Black Widow. It really just depends. Now, in terms of the comics, though, this is really sort of interesting. The comics have far less of a general audience appeal than movies, right? Movies are sort of, especially these big tentpole blockbusters, are geared toward general audiences. You don't have to like run to the comic books and read all of that material in order to understand what's happening on the screen in front of you. That being said, the comic books and the stories those comic books tell are much less geared for general audience appeal. And what that means is there's suddenly a lot more leniency and ambiguity in the writing of the comics that I think opens the door for some serious conversations about faith. And I'll give you a great example of this that was really misunderstood when it came out. There's a really brilliant writer by the name of Tom King, who just came off his Batman run in the comics. And Batman's an interesting character. You know, he's basically an anti-hero. He's what we shouldn't do. Be more like Superman, don't be Batman. That's the moral lesson of his character, which people seem to miss all the time. It's all over the Nolan films, the idea that Batman is Bruce Wayne's destruction, his emotional crutch, yet we celebrate the character in the public conscience, and it baffles me in some ways. Anyway, in Tom King's run, he wrote this absolutely amazing story called Cold Days that deals very explicitly with faith. The idea is that the idea of Batman is put on trial and Bruce Wayne is on the jury. And also on this jury is this Christian woman, and she and Bruce have this back and forth on faith that Hollywood would kill over at the thought of putting in a film, right? It would just never happen. And when these issues first released, audiences everywhere, even media outlets, started reporting that Batman was an atheist due to dialogue ripped out of context. And King, the writer, very smartly responded by simply saying essentially, "That's not how I took that. That's not what I was saying." And then he let the ambiguity stand on its own. And as soon as I read the story, I told my friend, who is a comic book reader and another seminary student, to drop everything he was doing and read the story. And when he finished, we were talking about it. And we both agreed that this was a really thought-provoking, complex take on superheroes and why people look for them and want them and how that plays into our desire for something greater. A writer who does this well with Wonder Woman, I think, is Greg Rucka, who leans very hard into the more mythological elements of the character and almost her divine abilities. To argue platonically, or as Lewis would take this, I think, would be to say something like, we are drawn to superheroes because we are drawn to the archetype of a hero. In the old song, the battle hymn of the Republic, there's that line that Julia Ward Howe wrote, "Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel," taken from Genesis 3:15. That's the idea. We innately look for that Christ-like hero and are therefore drawn to the characters that color him in lesser shades, like Superman and others. So I do think, depending on the story and the character, that yeah, as you asked, there are springboards into evangelism or even apologetic methods.
So let's talk specifically about the film now, Wonder Woman 84. And I just think that it's gotten a bunch of mixed reviews. I know that you communicate to me that you don't read reviews. You like to just experience the movies. But if we go on to, you know, Metacritic, it's received an average score of 60, which is on the lower side from people who critique movies, films, from large papers to websites and so forth. And so I would say that the reception has been somewhat mixed for this film, and both of us have seen it. But specifically in your film review, you talk about this kind of social anxiety that we have called FOMO, fear of missing out. And how does that relate to this film? And what can you tell us that you think it means, FOMO, for our culture?
Sure. So the so-called fear of missing out, or FOMO syndrome, really started being discussed, as far as I know, in the late 90s by marketing strategists, which is kind of interesting. And it has grown through avenues of psychology over the past, 20 years. And new technologies emerge as they've emerged in the past two decades or so. Very simply, what this social anxiety, as it is called, tries to explain is why we can now sit at a dinner table in a restaurant, look around, and see all these families sitting together but glued to their phones instead of talking with each other. The idea being that people have developed, you know, largely due to technology, this fear of not knowing what other people are doing. We have to be on Facebook and everybody else's business because we might not know that Bob and Sue are now in a relationship. You know what I mean? It's that idea that something isn't legitimate until it's Facebook official. Where this becomes dangerous, I think, you ask, what does this mean for the culture? Is that we run the risk of suddenly losing all sense of patience and longing, because I now don't have to wait on a phone call, or actually, let's go back further, on a letter from someone. I can just text them or send them a Snapchat picture or a Facebook message. I can project my thoughts to the world, split between, you know, four tweets, because I can't contain everything within 140 or 280 characters or whatever Twitter says now. So I think what this means for us is that we become a very impatient culture, one that is obsessive with instant gratification, and that we are a people who like to live for the moment.
And that is definitely something that we've all become accustomed to, like you said, because of technology. So how do you think that this film addresses cultural issues that arise from this anxiety, which is kind of interesting because they set this film in 1984. So it's full of a lot of 80s references and kind of, you know, the look of it, the art direction of how they did it, you know, kind of the 80s clothes and the 80s culture there. And, you know, one of the scenes is at the mall, so it's very mall-centric and things like that. So what do you think that this film in particular, with its focus on 1984, addresses the cultural issues that arise from this anxiety that's now?
Yeah, like you said, it's a really interesting choice that they set this film in the 80s. And I know we had talked a little bit before, you and I, about the film is almost campy in some ways. And I wonder if that's sort of intentional, especially the mall scene at the beginning. I almost wonder if that was done very intentionally as a way of, I don't know, trying to be like a throwback in a sense to those types of movies, which do have a sort of charm. And I guess, you know, it's a toss up as to whether or not that worked. Yeah, good observation. As far as how it speaks to now, I think, and this is, you know, just my take on this, I think it handles these things beautifully and without really spoiling, I guess, the plot details. It's set in the 80s and emerging technologies play a key role in the narrative. Now, I only saw this once, so you'll have to probably help me with some of the details, but I don't think that's a coincidental decision. Isn't it like broadcast televisions? Isn't that like a key role in the plot toward the end of the movie? The fact that there's a satellite that can actually beam onto TV screens the world over, isn't that like a crucial part of the plot? And so you have these broadcast TVs and these really crummy, cheap TV personalities, almost like those awful televangelists that play a key role in the plot. And the story essentially focuses on one of these types of personalities played by Pedro Pascal, who's in The Mandalorian, who suddenly gets this ability to give you what you want most right then. And he even talks about this in the context of the film. He calls it the power of positive thinking, which might seem a little goofy now, but was actually how people, like these television personalities, talk. And anybody who sat up late at night, you know, in a motel room, hating their lives, watching these guys talk, this is the type of stuff you get. And so in that sense, I think some of the campiness and the goofiness of the movie, it is actually intentional. It's channeling those types of vibes, if you will. And he has this ability to give you what you want most right then, as soon as you want it, but it comes at your expense. And the great moral of 1984, the great moral of this movie, is this real clarity of thought that Diana has to come to and ultimately push the world toward, which is that in the moment, if you want it, you can have the world. And it might seem like you get it, but there's always a trade-off. And the climax of the movie, where Diana sort of very stealthily takes over, and this broadcast and is speaking to people, speaking to the world, we lose the ability to suffer. She talks to them about suffering, essentially saying you're taking the quick and easy way and look at what's happening. We lose the ability to suffer. We lose the ability to have patience with one another and ourselves. Love is built in no small part on long suffering, on not cutting and running on whims or when the going gets tough. In other words, love is not divorcing after a squabble over who does the dishes next. It perseveres, it mends, it seeks to understand. And the film, I think, rather brilliantly says that the things worth having are things worth suffering for, are worth being patient for. And the film shows us what happens when people get what they want on whims and the world is burning for it. If you remember the scene in the streets, where you're sort of watching the world come undone as people get what they want. there is, it's not subtle, right, about this. And we can complain about how not subtle it is later, but it's not subtle when you see a street preacher, which is kind of one of those, it's almost like one of those things played to comedic effects in other movies. In this film, it's done very seriously. The trope is played straight. You have a street preacher calling for people to wake up and see what their greed is doing to the world. These films, I think the 2017 Wonder Woman film, and I think the idea is maybe not as a little more complexly done in 1984. I think they're very deeply theological in their understanding of humanity's depravity and the need for a heroic figure to emerge and point them to a better way. In this case, to show them how to suffer sacrificially. So that's at least how I think 84 addresses some of those issues that arise from the fear of missing out.
I do agree with you that the street preacher was not campy and was a sobering moment. It wasn't played, I didn't think, in a very derogatory way. But I just wonder, on the flip side, you know, of course, I've mentioned there's spoilers, that everybody renounces what they've wished for. And it seemed deeply humanistic in that, well, the world can be a better place if everyone would see how they could be a bad person and then be a better person. And I'm not sure, given the depravity of man that the Bible talks about, is it really realistic that everybody would be renouncing their wish? Because, you know, I've said in this podcast before, when we've talked about different generations, some of the younger generations, speaking of FOMO, some of their biggest goals in life are to be famous or to get what they want, those kinds of things. And so do you really think that everyone would simultaneously, I mean, I know it's a film, but just a majority of people would give up what they wish for, even if they could have seen the destruction in that moment? Some people would say, well, I take that because I do wish for, I don't know, money or fame or whatever it is.
Now we're getting down to brass tacks, and you've asked the real hard question here, the question about depravity, which is, do you think that people could do this? And no, I mean, Scripture's plain about this. I know Paul says, he's writing to Timothy, I think it is, and in 2 Timothy, he says, look, the world is going to do what the world wants. This is basically what he says. You know, the day is coming where everything you're talking about, no one's going to want to listen to you because of what you're preaching. And this is where I think we have to be very careful viewers of films. In other words, I think we have to be very careful readers of stories, and we have to look at the narrative context. So does Wonder Woman 1984 end with the world sort of renouncing their wishes? Yes. Yes, it happens. But in the context of the narrative, and this is what I think is important, in the context of the narrative, this does not happen until Diana speaks to them. It does not happen until someone has to come stepping in from the outside. See, I think the humanistic idea says, oh, well, people have this ability within themselves that if they just would do it, the world would be a better place. Well, as I'm watching the movie, you got the street preacher out here asking these people to, you know, look at what they're doing, and they're not listening to him. It takes Diana like hijacking these screens and coming in almost in a sense like the voice of God, what you might call the voice of truth, because that's literally what she talks about in that whole climax scene. She talks about the importance of truth and seeing reality the way it is, which is you can't get out of suffering. She comes breaking in and talking to these people, the idea within the context of the narrative being that they actually don't have this ability until someone comes in and shows them how to do it. And if I remember correctly, when she first comes onto the scene, then I thought this was very powerful in how they portrayed this. She tells the people, basically, I'm not coming to you speaking to you remotely. I know what this is. She had just, you know, a few minutes earlier, in order to go save the world, she had to renounce her own wish. She had to give up Steve. And she comes to these people and she tells them, you know, I wanted this more than anything, but for your sake, I've had to step away from it. I see now the truth that we have to suffer and suffer together, in a sense. And so in that sense, I think what the film does is position Diana almost as this messianic figure. In that way, she is very Christ-like, the person who comes to the people having gone through the experience and saying, I've done this, now let me show you a better way. And it takes that happening before the people finally renounce their own wishes and things fall back in line. That's just how I looked at that. I'd be happy to hear your take on these things.
Well, I just, like you said, I think we'll end on this, is I think that Christians need to be, you know, consumers of, whether it's books or popular culture, music, television, films, and those kinds of things, with discernment. And we hope that bringing you these things will help you develop in your discernment skills, because I do think you could read it that way, but there needs to be a reminder, especially if you took younger kids or maybe a middle schooler or a high schooler to see this film, to say, you know, the world, you know, this issue of sin and depravity that's very easily seen in the main villain that's portrayed by the actor from The Mandalorian, and that main villain is motivated, you know, by greed. And do we solve those issues by being better people and making the world better? No, the answer is the gospel. So I think I just resonate with what you say. We need to watch these things, you know, with discernment and care. But because, as we've published before in our journal, that television series and films are kind of like the new literature of our time, if Christians do watch them, they are good springboards to talk about some of these spiritual issues. So what did you think of these themes? What do you think, you know, what do you think about Wonder Woman giving up something that she had longed for, you know, and that she had missed because she's immortal from when someone died that she loved? So those are very interesting questions that we can talk to with people that maybe just coming out straight out talking about Christianity, they might not be as open to starting to ask some of those spiritual questions through some of these different series and films. Well, finally, I want to end on some fun rapid fire questions for Cole. So Cole, we're recording this in the morning. What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I just came back from there. I stopped in a local restaurant and had a pretty basic meal, eggs, bacon, sausage, and pancakes.
Well, it is the new year. It's a happy new year. Lots of people are making all kinds of resolutions, whether they're spiritual or health related, those kinds of things, reading the Bible. Do you have any resolutions? First of all, do you make resolutions? And do you have any for 2021?
I don't personally make them, but I have said that this year I think I'm going to try to work on some personal projects and get a little more writing done.
And we have been comparing and contrasting DC and Marvel. So DC or Marvel?
Oh, I knew that was coming. I guess it depends on the day for me. I think DC's character stories I'm a little more drawn to just because of the world that they play in. But I like characters from both sides a lot. So,
well, can you narrow it down to one? Who's your favorite superhero?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I actually really like the comics, Wonder Woman. Some of those stories I think are great. And I love Superman. But I think the character I grew up with, and this sounds like such a, you know, pandering answer, it probably really is Batman. That was the character that sort of got me into it and that kind of thing.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
I appreciate you having me, and it's always fun to talk to you.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Cole Burgett, who has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal about the new Wonder Woman film, and it's called Wonder Woman 1984, The Truth is Enough. And you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comments section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast
hosted by CRI President Hank Canagraph at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.